And I see that council are seated at table, and I'll just make a few preliminary remarks. Please don't hesitate to continue to settle yourselves in and organize your papers. So first of all, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're looking forward to the conversation that we'll have today. I want to make a few quick remarks just to remind you of things that you probably are well aware of, but I just want to make sure that we don't forget them in the excitement about today's argument and in our conversation. So when you approach the podium, if you will identify yourself for the record as well as the client you represent, that will keep our oral record very clear. And then secondly, do take whatever time you need to settle yourself in with paperwork so that you're ready to have a conversation with us and make any adjustments you want to the microphone and to the podium. Keep your eye on the clock. Now, I do see we've got several lawyers here. Have we any divisions of the argument, or have you already worked that out with the marshal? I'll ask appellant first. Any divisions, counsel?
From appellant's perspective, mm-hmm. we'll have appellant's 15 and the 5 rebuttal.
Right, and that's as normal. Go right ahead. Respondent, are you dividing your argument at all?
We are, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm going to take 13 minutes, and Ms. Rubish is going to take 2 minutes.
All right. And I take it that you've already arranged that with the marshal. So, Mr. Marshall will ask you to adjust their clock accordingly. I assume that that's what you want, because you, of course, have your option to just do it informally and continue a conversation, or we can have the marshal actually run the clock at 13 and then give 2 to Ms. Rubish.
I would appreciate it if
okay.
the marshal would run it at 13 and 2.
All right, very good. So, counsel for appellant, with that housekeeping out of the way, I'd want to invite you to begin when you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Daniel Bellig. I'm one of the attorneys representing the plaintiff appellant Corey Hendrickson in this matter. Getting straight into the substantive issues, what I want to stress for the court is a basic principle of law, and that is when there are no facts in dispute, there is no issue for the jury to decide. And that's what this case is all about. We have a motion for judgment as a matter of law based on concessions by Mr. Jensen in a trial record that is devoid as to any material issues of fact concerning his negligence and liability. I want to stress that we don't see many cases where a jury verdict is returned or reversed because there are no factual issues. And that's because this court, district courts, the Supreme Court, dispose of cases long before they get to trial because there are no facts in dispute. You see that in the Rule 12 judgment on the pleadings, Rule 56. So a lot of those cases where there are no factual disputes already disposed of before they get to the trial stage. This case is unique in that we get to trial, and by the close of evidence, there is nothing in dispute. There was nothing for the jury to decide as to negligence. So what was undisputed? It is undisputed here that Mr. Jensen disregarded all reasonableness and ignored numerous warnings, instructions, and plain common sense when installing a propane-burning furnace without the qualifications to do so, against the manufacturer's instructions, and with improper plastic tubing to exhaust deadly carbon monoxide. The cause of Ms. Hendrickson's death is also undisputed, despite a jury finding to the contrary, and that is that the hole in the plastic tubing, the improper plastic tubing, melted because of the heat of the exhaust and allowed carbon monoxide to infiltrate the fish house.
Mr. Bellick, I just want to move you forward a little bit. You and counsel for plaintiff throughout trial requested a curative instruction repeatedly, which was never granted by the district court. That, from your perspective, I would imagine, it was obviously a way to cure what you viewed as an improper argument about reasonable person. It seems though you did not want. Another alternative might have been to have these other individuals on the verdict form, which, certainly you can put people who are not parties on the special verdict form for an allocation of fault. But you took the position in your summary judgment motion that you did not want that as an alternative. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor, so you're getting to the core issue on a request for a new trial, which is sort of the confusion of what's going on here. And so you go back to the trial record, and defense counsel mentions in her arguments about the curative instruction how there were, quote, a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And what we wanted to do is get to this trial on the discrete issue of Mr. Jensen's negligence, because it was clear that while there were other people sort of on the periphery of the events of Ms. Hendrickson's death, they weren't, one, they either owed no duty and therefore didn't have to act reasonably, or two, they weren't the causative, ultimate causative factor. And I think that that can be difficult for a jury to understand at the outset, because it really is sort of this technical perspective, right? So you have Mr. Pitlewski, who did the wiring, and then the suggestion, well, you know, if he did it, you know, without qualifications or this, why is he not on the verdict form? It's a good, if I were a juror, I'd be wondering that as well. And the reason he's not on there, and the reason the jury should never apportion fault to him, or can't under the law, is because, as, you know, unfortunate as it may be, he simply owed no legal duty to Mrs. Hendrickson. The same with the carbon monoxide detector. Even if he knew there was no battery in there or had reason to know to check it, yes, it was unreasonable for Mr. Pitlewski to not do that, but he owed no legal duty. How do we explain this to a jury? Because the reasonableness test under the law is that what would a reasonable person similarly situated do? Well, these people, while they're on the periphery, they're not in the same situation. Pitlewski didn't have the same course and scope of work with respect to the furnace. Green ordered it, but he wasn't there. He didn't realize it couldn't be installed this way. He didn't make the plastic tubing decision. And, you know, Rogers was way out, you know, in time and distance from the accident. So, you know, we wanted to get in a position where, hey, we're focusing on the one person who could potentially have legal liability under the law, and that's Mr. Jensen. And then we get to trial, and you have this situation where, well, these facts end up coming in because it's part of the overall narrative, but to someone who's not familiar with, you know, duty and all these aspects of negligence law, we've got to explain to them how this is going to work. And what's really telling here is that the defendants in their briefing here are saying, well, you know, we didn't actually say they were negligent, okay? But
everyone made mistakes.
Everyone made mistakes, but here at the same time, they're asking the district court in the middle of trial, hey, you need to reverse your summary judgment decision. So based on the same facts they're telling the jury, hey, you can use their conduct to say Jensen wasn't negligent, they're telling the court, no, you need to bring these people back in because they are. Well, so that tells you that the jury at least is probably thinking these people were probably negligent too, but if they're not here, well, what does that tell us about Jensen? And it's very confusing. If I could point the court to one aspect of the Raja case.
I did want you to respond to that, and I'd like to hear from respondent about that case. I don't think they did address it in their brief.
No, they did not.
Page Raja, by the way.
Raja. Excuse my error on that, Your Honor.
It's my part of the country.
Okay. Page 702, and here's what the court goes on to say, is that even though defendant's final argument scrupulously avoided the issue, and they're talking about the contributory negligence of the plaintiff here, it would be unrealistic to conclude, under the circumstances disclosed by this record, that the jury did not have in mind defendant's claim that plaintiff's conduct contributed as a cause of the accident, and that this did not lead to their finding of no liability. So what they're saying is, look, we have to look at the record and look at it in totality, and the question is, all right, is there a potential for confusion here? If there is, then it's reversible error not to give that curative instruction.
So and building on Judge Hallbrook's question, Mr. Bellig, you said that in terms of additional names on the ballot or on the verdict that if there isn't a duty, they didn't have a responsibility to act reasonably, so they wouldn't be on the, there was no basis for those other individuals. But you also said unless there was other some sort of causative explanation. Are you referring to like an intervening cause or something that even though Mr. Jensen was perhaps negligent, if there was someone else whose conduct intervened regardless of that negligence, they should be on the verdict form?
Okay, and so you've identified where our analysis diverged with that of the district court at summary judgment. So when we go into summary judgment, we approached it for more of a causative aspect, like deciding which furnace to order that Mr. Green did way back in time didn't have any direct It wasn't proximate enough to the accident, because then you had Jensen who got it and said, oh, wait, this isn't it, but I'm going to install it anyway, but Green wasn't involved. The district court, so that was more of a causation thing we were presenting to the district court on summary judgment. The district court took a different route, as I understand its order, and went down the foreseeability analysis. So there was a divergence there. I mean, we got the result, but on different grounds. Either way, if you have no duty, you shouldn't be on the verdict form. And if you have no proximate cause to the damages, you shouldn't be there either. That's one of the disputes, one of the legal issues, I think, that has come up from the defense, is that they're arguing, well, you don't need a duty to be on the comparative fault analysis. And we disagree with them on that legal issue, because the comparative fault statute itself uses the term negligence or tort. I'd have to pull it up to give you an exact quote. But negligence, if it uses the term negligence, all of the cases say an essential element of negligence is duty. And so, you know, we think you have to have an underlying legal duty to get a person's name put on the comparative fault analysis.
So did Mr. Green, as a co-owner of the fish house, have a duty? Did he owe a duty to those that were using his fish house to maintain it in a safe way?
In our brief, we do suggest that among the legal duties owed by both Green and Mr. Jensen here are a premises liability duty among the affirmative act type duty. So we agree with that. I know there's a disagreement from Mr. Green on that. But yes, we agree there was a premises liability duty. But that's also why, on summary judgment, we took that other route as to the proximate cause issue. So the court just came down a different way on that at the district court level, if that makes sense. All right. One of the other things that I wanted to stress here is that in the defendant's response to our appeal, one, they don't accept the district court's rationale for denying JMAL, but they take a little bit different approach, and it's one I haven't really seen before, and that is, well, Mr. Jensen essentially didn't know what he was doing, so how can he be negligent? And our position is that proceeding with the installation of a dangerous appliance that everyone in common sense recognizes a dangerous appliance, proceeding with that installation, being ignorant, is negligence in and of itself. And that takes you to the Zurcher case. And there they say, the court says, it has been held that where knowledge is necessary to careful conduct in the installation and operation of an appliance discharging carbon monoxide gas, voluntary ignorance is equivalent to negligence. And the other principles of law that dovetail into that as well, you find in the restatement, talking about those who engage or undertake to engage in work that's typically done by a tradesperson or a profession, are held to the standard of the tradesperson and profession. So Mr. Jensen can't say, well, I didn't know what I was doing, so I wasn't negligent. That, in fact, is under these principles a concession of negligence that I think entitles the plaintiff to judgment as a matter of law in this case.
So conceptually, I think it's easier for me anyway to get my head around the party's arguments on the JMAL, you know, motion and denial here. And our standard of review certainly is different for that, and we can look at the case. In your remaining time, I would appreciate if we could address some of your claims on your request for a new trial, because some of them are evidentiary rulings where we're looking at whether or not the district court abused its discretion and whether there was prejudice if they did, and in analyzing whether a new trial is appropriate. And so to the extent that you can do so in 2.5 minutes, I think it would be helpful for us to hear some of your thoughts on that. Any points of your brief that you think you want to highlight that you think perhaps are stronger than others?
Sure, and actually I can flow right into that. From discussing the ignorance question to the denial of our expert testimony, which, if the standard for someone engaging in the installation of an appliance is that of a tradesman, I think that emphasizes our arguments here on why we needed to get out that additional testimony from our expert about the quality of the manual that was involved, as well as whether it was reasonable for someone to be installing it to do this, that, or the other thing.
But the expert was permitted to say that Mr. Jensen did not follow it, correct?
Right, but that isn't even of itself, I think, the subject of expert testimony. Mr. Jensen conceded that. The subject of expert testimony is, well, did he need to follow it, and whether it was appropriate to do so or not. To emphasize to the jury that this is the standard of care that applies in this case. And, you know, without that evidence, I think it's easy for the jury to remain confused about why these other people aren't involved. While this particular individual is not acting as others, he's acting as a tradesman, as a professional, in doing the full installation except the wiring, of course.
It seemed to me the district court limited the expert's testimony because of a lack of foundation on the construction of a manual or writing of a manual. Am I correct on that?
On that little aspect, I think you may be correct. I would have to go back and exactly look at that. I think the bigger issue was whether, you know, where the court was going to draw the line on whether the testimony was one as to negligence or an ultimate issue, and that's sort of a fine line. Like, how close can you get to saying, the expert saying, well, he was negligent? Well, there are cases that say you can't do that, but then there are cases that are softer that say you can get up to that point by talking about reasonableness in the particular conduct of the facts. And so I think the district court drew the line too far the other way in limiting the testimony. He should have been able to say this was not reasonable, but it would be fair to stop short of saying exactly he was negligent. That takes away the issue from the jury, and there are cases you say you can't do that. So I think that line needs to be moved back if JMOL isn't given to us and there's a reversal for a new trial. I think that error in particular needs to be corrected. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Wills, and I represent the respondent, Tristan Jensen. Mr. Jensen respectfully requests that this court affirm the jury's verdict and the district court's order denying Mr. Hendrickson's post-trial motions. As the court is aware, this case was tried for 3 days in July of 2018 in Fairmont, Minnesota. A Martin County jury of 6 men and 1 woman heard from 16 witnesses. They received 99 documents. After they considered all of the evidence, they deliberated for 4.5 hours, and they concluded that Mr. Jensen was not negligent.
My review of the record would suggest that everybody was surprised by that verdict. Mr. Wills, I mean, even in the arguments at summary judgment, there was an acknowledgement of duty. There was an acknowledgement of an improper installation. There's an acknowledgement that as a result of that improper installation, this tubing collapsed and caused the death of this young woman. I have a really hard time understanding how the jury came to the verdict they did on the negligence issue. And so I just want you to know what my concerns are here, because I don't know how they came up with that verdict. I know what the arguments are to the contrary, but I don't know how you get around those basic, uncontroverted, undisputed facts.
Your Honor, I can certainly appreciate that, but respectfully, whether we can individually look at it and say, gosh, you know, we would have reached a different decision. I would have reached a different decision on the jury. You, Your Honor, would have reached a different decision. It doesn't matter. The question, respectfully, it doesn't matter, because the question is there reasonably competent evidence within the record when you view all of that evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict and you take all inferences?
I agree with all of that. What is it?
All right. Your Honor, we discussed this at some length in our brief, but I think we start first with the fact that on January 14, 2017, when Mr. Jensen goes to install this heater, he is faced with a set of circumstances that he didn't create. Mr.
He didn't have to install it that day, though.
I don't necessarily disagree, Your Honor, but he does install it that day, and it's based on a set of circumstances that he doesn't create, and that's important.
Well, it's based on judgments he made based on the circumstances, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But the circumstances that he faces are not of his own making. Mr. Rogers is the one who designs and builds the fish house. He's the one that chooses where to put the heater and where to put the vent for the heater.
Is there any evidence admitted at the trial that suggested that the design of the fish house was somehow dangerous?
There was some, Your Honor. There was a significant amount of evidence that was kept from the jury. We did have an expert, Dave Hallman, who would have testified at trial.
I don't know what the jury heard, though.
I don't believe that the jury heard any evidence that the design was inherently dangerous. They hear that.
Didn't the district court make a decision on summary judgment that Mr. Rogers was not going to be on the verdict form?
You're correct, Your Honor.
Is that right? So that explains this the focus of the evidence at trial.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Right.
They did hear that Mr. Rogers was the one who chose where to put this heater, but they did not hear any evidence that, you know, that was a mistake or that that was an error or that in and of itself was inherently dangerous. Now, at trial, the jury also heard from Mr. Green, and Mr. Green testified that he's the one that researched and selected this specific heater. Mr. Jensen ultimately orders the heater, and when the heater arrives at Mr. Jensen's house, he takes a look at the heater, he takes a look at the installation manual, and he realizes that he has a problem. He cannot install this heater in this fish house in accordance with the instructions in the installation manual. So what does he do? Well, the one thing that he doesn't do is run out to the fish house right away and try and jerry-rig some sort of situation so that he can put the heater in that fish house. He picks up the phone and he calls the experts. He calls Days Plumbing and Heating. And at this point, we need to look at the evidence according to what Mr. Jensen testified to and what Mr. Pitletsky testified to. They both testified that Mr. Jensen attempts to explain the problem that he's having to Days Plumbing, and that the person on the other end of the phone can't seem to understand why exactly Mr. Jensen can't install this thing in accordance with the installation manual's instructions. Now, Mr. Pitletsky testifies very specifically at trial that during this conversation, Mr. Jensen says, well, can I use flexible tubing to connect the back of the heater to the exhaust port on the fish house? Neither Mr. Jensen nor Mr. Pitletsky testify that anyone from Days Plumbing tells them, absolutely not. You can't do that. You have to use a hard metal connection. You have to make sure that it's flush against the exterior of the fish house.
The manual said it had to be flush, right?
You're correct.
But as you've already said, Mr. Jensen admitted that he did not follow the manual because he did not install this furnace flush either with the exterior or the cabinetry.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so I don't know that this additional evidence that you're hypothesizing would have made any difference.
Well, Your Honor, it's not additional evidence that I'm hypothesizing. It's evidence that the jury heard. They heard that Mr. Jensen picked up the phone and that he had this conversation with Days, with the expert, to try and ask them for guidance on how he's supposed to install this thing, and that there's no mention that, nope, you can't use this flexible tubing and you absolutely have to follow the instructions that you've got in the installation manual.
I want to just divert this slightly, because this seems to me like the same argument that was made to the jury. All these other actors, you know, contributing to the death of this young woman. And what I'm really focused on is this argument that seemed to me to pervade the way the case was tried and closing argument about, you know, the reasonable person here. And I think that what I'd like to have you explain is, it seems to me what reasonable person was used in this way was subjective, as opposed to an objective standard. And I'm looking at the closing and saying, I'd suggest to you, we've got a lot of examples here of other folks, and I'm not saying they were negligent, but a lot of other examples that made mistakes in this case. And that's his peer group, and you go through various people. And again, there's an objection by Mr. Stagerberg and a discussion at the bench, and apparently the objection was overruled, because then again, Mr. Petz comes back and says, as I was saying, sorry for the interruption. In order to determine the reasonable person standard, we have to look at what other people did in this case. And then again, starting to go through Rogers and these other individuals, including the person at Days. I feel like the jury was asked to compare Mr. Jensen's fault with the fault of these other individuals, and that therefore the argument was, even though I don't think the district court permitted it by its rulings, but said, I'm going to let them speak to the facts and that kind of thing. But the argument seemed to be these people made mistakes, and so did Mr. Jensen, and nobody's negligent. I mean, is that a reasonable person from an objective standard?
Well, Your Honor, I want to start with the first question that you asked, which is, was the argument in closing an attempt to compare fault by, Mr. Jensen and then other folks at trial? And I respectfully disagree. I don't think there was any argument other than a passing argument, and I highlighted that in my brief.
Would you agree what I just read was that type of argument?
I do agree, Your Honor, that there was a comment that Mr. Potts made, and you can call him Mr. Petz if you'd like to.
That
there were other people that made mistakes here. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that at the bench conference, the judge said you can't say that, and that after the judge told Mr. Potts you can't say that, that he backed off of, calling what these other people did mistakes. How I viewed Mr. Potts's closing argument was primarily that he was saying, look, when you determine whether Tristan acted reasonably in this case, you have to specifically look at the circumstances that he was acting in.
Well,
the
Mr.
fact
Rose,
that
I'll take issue with you, because after that ruling, whatever it was, 2 pages later, again, we need to compare Tristan's actions to people like Jared Green in his peer group. That includes Logan and so forth. I mean, it continued to be the theme.
And, Your Honor, I think the primary focus of the argument was when you're trying to figure out who the reasonable person is who's installing this furnace and what they should do, you need to look at these people like Logan and like Jared Green, who don't have 40 years of experience in the HVAC industry,
what
like
does
Mr. Puncher.
To do with his negligence?
Because I think it goes specifically and directly to the reasonable person standard. Is the reasonable person in this situation somebody who has 40 years of HVAC experience, or is it someone that is, or is it somebody that does not have 40 years of HVAC experience? Now, Mr. Bellig
Counsel,
mentioned
if the argument had just been about the qualifications for the appellant's plumber to speak, or the installer. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the expert's name. That would be one thing, but that's not Judge Hallbrook's question. She's asking about whether it is improper argument for defense counsel in closing to compare Mr. Jensen's conduct to the conduct of individuals who, as a matter of law, owed no duty to the decedent in this case.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And like I said earlier, I did not read Mr. Potts's closing argument as though he was saying, look at what all of these other folks did, and yet they're not on the verdict form, and you're not being asked to determine whether they were negligent. The way that I read the argument is much more that what Mr. Potts is saying is, look, when you consider the circumstances that Mr. Jensen was facing that day, you have to consider what all of these other people did in particular. Not saying, look, these people are at fault and you have to find them at fault and here's why they're at fault, here's how they created a danger. But those individuals, Mr. Pitletsky, not checking to see whether there's a carbon monoxide detector, even though he's aware that there's a carbon monoxide detector in there.
Because you have a minute and 40 seconds set left. I appreciate you don't read it that way. You didn't hear it that way if you were in the courtroom. But we don't know if this confused the jury or not, and that seems to be the ultimate question. And could you address Raha?
I can, Your Honor. In the Raha case, what specifically happens, and the opinion's very short, so I don't have a good context of what the evidence was at trial, but there is a notation in the opinion that the defense attorney specifically asked questions that were specifically designed to point the finger at the plaintiff and to say that the plaintiff was at fault because she failed to keep an adequate lookout, she failed to provide a warning about this washout area that was up ahead, and you know, she failed to do a couple of other things. And there were apparently some comments in the opening statement of the defense lawyer to that effect, that the plaintiff herself was at fault and was negligent. If the court goes back and looks through the transcript, I think it will see very clearly. So within that context, when the judge then decides at the very end of the trial, look, I'm not going to put these people on the verdict form and I'm not going to give an instruction about contributory negligence, the Minnesota Supreme Court says, well, that created a confusing circumstance because you allowed the jury to hear specific and pointed questions that the plaintiff was at fault here, but then you don't submit that issue to the jury and you don't give a curative instruction on that. It's significantly different here. There aren't...
I was asked, though, Mr. Pislesky, you were under there. You saw that plastic tubing. I mean, the clear inference was he didn't do anything about it or didn't think it was a problem. I mean, that's right in the transcript.
Your Honor, my time's going to run out. Can I respond to your question?
You can respond, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. There were certainly questions about what other people saw and what other people did. There were not questions, though, that crossed the line and directly suggested to that jury that other people were responsible, other than one. There was one question to Mr. Green about whether he made a mistake in the furnace that he selected. But other than that, the questions that were asked were pointed and direct as to what people saw and as to what people did, and they were not, did you commit an error? Did you make a mistake? Do you wish that you could do this all over again? Would you have done this differently? They did not suggest to the jury directly that that individual was at fault. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Renee Rubish. I represent respondent Jared Green. My remarks are limited to the cross appeal by Tristan Jensen against my client. The district court granted summary judgment in favor of Jared Green because he did not owe a duty of care to Ashton Hendrickson. Mr. Jensen argues on appeal that he did in fact owe a duty for two reasons, that he selected the wrong heater, and that he knew or should have known that Mr. Jensen would not be able to install the heater in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions. According to the case law, Jared Green owes a duty to protect only if the risk of injury is objectively reasonable for Green to expect, that the risk of injury is to a foreseeable plaintiff, and that the connection between the danger and Green's conduct was not too remote. The evidence is here that Green did not participate in, have knowledge of, or input into the selection of the flexible plastic tubing. He did not participate in, have knowledge of, or input into the installation of this new furnace. He was in South Dakota at a concert. He did not know Mr. Jensen had even received the furnace that day. He did not know it was going to be installed that day. He was not called about the installation.
Aren't these distinctions, though, between duty and direct cause?
There is an overlap. We presented our motion for summary judgment based on a lack of duty of care, because that is something that, as a matter of law, the judge can decide. As this case has proceeded, there is no causation. There is a lack of proximate cause here. Jared Green's conduct is just too far remote for this.
So, Mr. Rubish, we have not come to any conclusion as a panel about resolution of this, but if we were to remand for a new trial, should the summary judgment be decided anew with respect to Green?
I believe no, Your Honor.
Could you just speak briefly to that?
I believe the facts will always, even after trial, have come through that Mr. Green had no knowledge, involvement, to give rise to a duty, and the facts that have come out is that there was no causation. And so we're asking that this court affirm the district court's summary judgment, and if this court decides that this case has a new trial, Mr. Green should not be part of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think
looking at this from whether the arguments related to an objective versus a subjective standard is the proper way to go here. Because nowhere in the record is there any evidence that Green, Rogers, Pitlewski, any other people on the periphery stood in the same position as Jensen. Jensen installed the furnace alone. Jensen went and got the tubing alone. This was all done alone. If they wanted to attack the reasonable person standard, they don't do it with people who had nothing to do with the installation. What they needed to do it with, because Mr. Jensen was acting as a tradesperson, was what other installers would have done in that situation. That's the objective standard. That's the same or similarly situated person, a tradesperson who would have installed this. And there's no evidence that any tradesperson would have installed this against the installation manual whatsoever. I want to also turn to this, the comment from Judge Hallbrooks about we don't know what the jury ultimately did in the absence of this instruction and how it came to its conclusion. And Raja tells us, of course, that the instruction should be there. And where the court needs to look is Daly versus McFarland and Christie versus Christie. And that's where the precedent tells us if you have a situation where there's confusion or misleading of the jury and there's a question about what effect instruction may or may not have, then that's a situation where you have to reverse for a new trial.
So, counsel, I want to make sure I understand what you think appropriate relief would be if this panel were to reverse and order a new trial. So I see that, in particular, you've called out the curative instructions, and those were mentioned earlier in this argument. You proposed three of them, I think. That, to me, read very similarly. And so if those curative instructions were given and your expert was allowed to testify as to the negligence of Mr. Jensen, or the reasonableness, let's put it that way, of the installation by Mr. Jensen, is that what the relief that you're seeking in terms of specific directions to the district court for a new trial?
On a remand, that would be correct, Your Honor, I think.
So you're not seeking any additional, you know, there were objections made during closing argument, the closing argument of defense counsel as to the scope of the argument and the appropriateness of certain arguments.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Page 2 of the transcript, the issue of the scope of evidence, discussion, mention of this reasonableness and all of that stuff. That's page 2 of the transcript. So I think with the curative instruction and the court applying the rule of law, I think it would be appropriate for the district court to go back and presented with motions in limine on any retrial, consider what this court has said about whether it's objective versus subjective and that sort of thing. We would probably make those motions, and that I think you can see the scope of what we were asking for. I mean, this issue was the first thing out of the gate before anything else happens at this trial. And so I think, the instructions need to be very particular, that the court at least should be cautious about what type of tone or words are used even in getting testimony out of witnesses and that sort of a thing. I can't give you per witness here they shouldn't say this or that. I didn't prepare that or put that in the brief. But
no, I just want to be clear, since your conclusion in your brief is fairly general in terms of what directions that you would ask be given to the district court, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Now, on the other hand, if we were to grant relief on the cross appeal and indicate that the district court erred in its summary judgment decision, that would obviously affect the instructions on remand.
Right. So If there was a finding that maybe there was an issue of fact to duty or something like that, that would change whether or not an instruction would even be appropriate, because if they did have a duty and they're on the verdict form, then, different types of evidence are going to come in, and I think the arguments from both sides would be a little bit different as to how you impute fault and that sort of a thing. So that would definitely change the dynamic of how you would, if at all, instruct the jury on the issue of the fault of others, certainly. All right, and I am out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to all counsel in this case. The matter was well-briefed and well-argued. It is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.